You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
How many people here admit they watch TV, right? A few, okay. You may have seen this program. This is a show, I think it's on the Discovery channel, called Mythbusters. And this is one of my favorite shows. I don't know if you've ever seen it. But the idea is that these two guys take an urban legend and put it to the test. Say, you know, is this really true? Everybody thinks this is true. But, you know, what if we really look, you know, has anyone ever really tried this? And you know, it usually ends up in mayhem and crash test dummies, you know, being dropped in rivers and things like that. But I thought I wanted to try a little bit of that tonight with Canada's role in the world and our defense policy and what's happening. Some of those things that we hear all the time in the media over and over again. But let's put some of that to the test. So here's our first one. Okay, so this is urban legend number one. Nobody does UN peacekeeping these days, so Canada doesn't need to contribute UN troops anymore. Is this a fact or a myth? Well, I want to share with you a chart, some research from Professor Walter Dorn that we've included in this report that says something quite different. This chart that we're seeing here tracks UN peacekeeping, the level of UN peacekeeping, from 1990 up until the current date of 2006. All right? So here you see, this is the number of UN peacekeepers deployed in the world during that time period. In the post-Cold War period, there was a huge increase of peacekeepers around the world, up to almost 80,000 at its peak, of blue beret military and police doing the work of UN-led peacekeeping operations. There was a decline in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s, as you can see, mostly after Rwanda and that dark period of peacekeeping. But then in the late 1990s, around 2000, you see what happens. The demand for peacekeeping grows. More missions are added on. The UN is struggling, actually, to keep up with the demand that's on it. UN troops, they don't have their own standing army. They rely on countries to contribute troops to UN peacekeeping. And so the numbers increased and increased until right now we're just below the peak of 80,000. And in fact, this is from August of 2006. I just received an email from Professor Walter Dorn, who teaches at the Canadian Forces College, by the way, in Toronto. He teaches Canadian military personnel. He sent an email to me today saying that as of the end of October, UN peacekeeping has broken the record right now. There are more than 80,000 blue helmet soldiers out doing hard scratch peacekeeping around the world. So this goes up even higher than where it is today. So peacekeeping now is more active than it's ever been. Now, what's Canada's contribution to this? Where does Canada stand in peacekeeping? And I want to share with you this next slide, again from Professor Dorn's research. This ranks Canadian personnel contributed to the UN peacekeeping operations. And as you see, in the early 1990s again, we had that same spike before, Canada was a major contributor. Up to almost 3,500 soldiers were sent on blue helmet peacekeeping missions around the world in the early 1990s. It declined as overall UN peacekeeping declined, as you remember in the previous slide. But look what happened. In the late 1990s, when UN peacekeeping started going on the rise again, here we are, we're just continuing on. This is the 500 line, less than 500 until, hello, here we are, hello. So, 3,500 almost there, down to 56. 56, so we're down to 56 blue helmet troops from a high of almost 3,500 today. If you look at it another way, in terms of contributing to UN peacekeeping missions, the UN keeps very good records of this. You can go and look at this yourself. This is available on the UN website. Back in 1991, what was Canada's ranking amongst all contributors to UN peacekeeping? We were number one. We were the number one contributor of troops for UN peacekeeping missions around the world. Throughout most of the 1990s, we stayed relatively high within the top 10, but then the big drop comes in the late 1980s until by today. There's a little spike there. You know, we're down in the low 30s. And at the end of this study in August, we were down to 52 of 97 countries contributing UN troops. And Professor Doran sent me an email today. He said the new numbers are out. It's even worse. We've broken below 60 now. So the new numbers are less than 60 in ranking of the world. So really, Canada has abandoned UN peacekeeping. It's pretty clear. Even though polling has shown, even as late as last fall, that 70% of Canadians feel that UN peacekeeping is a defining characteristic of Canada. They feel that this is a main role in our greatest contribution to the world. And the irony is that this month, while UN peacekeeping is breaking all records, this is the 50th anniversary of the birth of peacekeeping, which was driven by Lester Pearson 50 years ago in the Suez Crisis, and which he won the Peace Prize a year later. But are there any parades? Are there any commemorative stamps, new coins or anything, new monuments marking that? No, nothing. Because the government really wants us to forget about that part of our history and doesn't want to mark UN peacekeeping. Let's look at it another way in terms of dollars. For every $10 spent on Canadian missions abroad, how much was spent on UN-led missions? Well, in 1992 and 1993, we were spending $9.27. So almost all of every $10 was spent on a UN-led mission. Fast forward to 2004-05, for every $10, how much was spent on UN-led missions? 31 cents. 31 cents. Barely anything at all. And if we compare it even more, the government just put out their new estimates on spending in Afghanistan and UN. So the new military spending estimates were just released by the UN just a few weeks ago. So let's have a comparison. Military spending on Afghanistan versus UN peacekeeping in 2006-07. The war in Afghanistan will cost Canada $1.6 billion. UN peacekeeping, 6 million. 233 times smaller will be the amount that we spend on UN peacekeeping. And interestingly enough, the government issued its estimates on the cost of the war in Afghanistan earlier this year, in early September, and pegged it at $1.4 billion. And then within about 6 weeks, they had to go back and increase it and add another $200 million onto the mission. A lot of it was as a result of the decision to send those Leopard battle tanks to Afghanistan, which cost a couple of $100 million. And as you may have heard in the news, where last night, Canada is now considering buying new shells that go in these new howitzers that we bought that cost $150,000 each. How many nurses' salaries is that in each shell? That's at least 1.5 social housing units in each shell that we're firing. And we just fire countless numbers of these in Afghanistan. And it's the latest piece of equipment, and it's lining the pockets of Raytheon Corporation is what it is, because it's a brand new piece of equipment. So really, you can see that we've abandoned UN peacekeeping. But I just want to share with you some of the research. One of the other arguments that we find out there is that UN peacekeeping isn't effective anymore. You know, that's the reason Canada doesn't do it, that it doesn't work. Again, let's put it to the test. The RAND Corporation, a very conservative American defense think tank in the U.S., was asked to look at UN missions and compare them to U.S. missions. And this is what the RAND Corporation found in 2005. Among those studied, 2/3 of UN nation-building operations can be counted as successful at this time, compared with only half of U.S. missions. 2/3 UN missions are successful, only 50% of U.S. missions are considered successful. Within limits, UN peacekeeping is a highly efficient means of placing post-conflict societies on the path to enduring peace and democratic government, and the most efficient form of international intervention so far documented. Now, this is not the left-leaning Polaris Institute study I'm quoting here, okay? This is the RAND Corporation, okay? This is a very conservative think tank in the U.S. that has done this determination of peacekeeping. So, and I was amazed to find this article in the Ottawa Citizen the other day that apparently the United States is now vying to host, to hold the top peacekeeping position at the UN. And it says, experts say having Americans in charge of the world's Blue Berets could give the U.S. a way out of Iraq. So even the Bush administration is admitting now that the UN plays an important role, and while they're caught in this quagmire, they've come crawling back to New York to try to find help to get out of this mess. Remember John Bolton said you could lock, their American ambassador to the UN said you could take the top 10 stories off the UN building and no one would notice? Well, it's a different tune today, clearly. So let's go remind ourselves, nobody does UN peacekeeping these days, so Canada doesn't need to contribute UN troops anymore. Well, clearly that is a myth. That is a myth. And UN peacekeeping is more active than ever. This year, breaking the previous record for the number of blue helmets. And it's Canada that's abandoned the UN, has abandoned UN peacekeeping. Once the number one contributor, we're now ranking 52 of 97. And as I mentioned, the latest information is that we've dropped below 60, or only 56 soldiers. In fact, today you can take all our peacekeepers and fit them on a single school bus. There they go. Send them off to New York. There's our peacekeepers on the school bus. Have a nice day. So it's appalling. Now, so if you look at this, the UN is making an incredible contribution in the world in some of the darkest parts of the world, mostly in Africa, the places that that is not getting on the front pages of the newspaper anymore. But it's incredibly effective. It's making a difference, and Canada is not making its own fair share contribution. We are freeloaders on the United Nations because we all benefit from the peace and development and security building work that the UN does around the world. We all benefit here in Canada because of that. It makes the world a safer place, including for us. It builds common security. And if we're not there, we're freeloading. We're freeloading. Okay, let's try our next one. Canada spends too little money on defense, about as much as Luxembourg. Has anybody heard this Luxembourg comparison? Yeah, I hear, if I had a dollar every time I hear this. This is just wild, and I'll come back to this in a little bit. Okay, so is this a fact or is it a myth? Well, Mythbusters, let's put it to the test. I say let's go to NATO. NATO keeps really good records of all of their member countries' military spending numbers. In fact, something they often remind us of. So let's have a look and say, well, this is NATO military spending, which was produced in 2004, and this is an estimate in U.S. millions. All of these figures are converted to U.S. dollars, so we're comparing apples to apples. And here are the top military spenders in NATO. Number one is the United States, followed by France, the UK, Germany, then we have Italy, Russia by comparison. Number six is Spain. Canada is number seven. Turkey's number eight. And in fact, there's 26 members of NATO. So this list goes, you know, right down into the basement, into the parking garage here. And we're still within the top 10 at 11.6 billion US dollars in 2004. Dollar for dollar, we are a very high military spender. There are different ways to measure military spending and compare it. There's a per capita method by comparing to how many people are in your country. But most analysts don't use that because it understates China and India. So that's probably the least best way to do it. Then there's the percentage of GDP. And this is where the Luxembourg gambit comes in. Because when the defense lobbyist comes on, the guy who wants to get more military spending, he says, we spend as much as Luxembourg. He's really talking about a percentage of GDP. That is a percentage of our overall economy. How much do we spend on defense compared to our overall economy? And we're at about 1.2, 1.3% of GDP, and Luxembourg is at 1.1%. So it is nominally true statistically, but it's a sleight of hand, because when they say Luxembourg, what do you think? You think tiny, like Luxembourg, like that's the size of my backyard. You know, what do they spend? $10? You know, are we spending $10 on our military? That's appalling. You know, it's designed to get that kind of result. But of course, if there's any statisticians in here, or anybody that can figure out grade 9 algebra, and I need a lot of help with, but they will, trust me, they will tell you that if when you're comparing percentages, it doesn't matter how big the overall economy is. They're talking about a percentage. So it's the fact that it's Luxembourg or the United States, it doesn't matter because they're talking about a percentage. The fact that they use Luxembourg is a sleight of hand. And I myself, you know, when I was testifying before the Defense Committee, there was John McCallum, a former Liberal defense minister, who gave me this Luxembourg line. I couldn't believe it. Because not only is he a former banker, but he's an economist, and that man should know better. In fact, I think he does know better. But he was still using this phony Luxembourg comparison. Let's see what's been... Let's take a look at the historical trends of Canada's military spending here. Okay, we've tracked Canada's military spending from 1980 up until 2011. Okay? So we've got this line on the chart here, and you see it's got a big bump during the 1980s, a decline during the 1990s, and then it starts going up again. I just want to point out a couple of things to you. And I should say these numbers are all adjusted, okay? So we're all talking about $2,005, so we've taken inflation into consideration. So the big increases actually happened during Trudeau's time, not really during Mulroney. It was Trudeau that really boosted military spending in the early part of the 1980s. Mulroney, during the Conservatives, certainly increased it during this period until we get up to this point, which is 1990. What happened in 1990? Thank you. End of the Cold War. Berlin Wall falls. Okay? So all military budgets around the world begin to go on the decline. And Canada was no different. The United States, Russia, everybody started reducing military spending. Up until the late 1990s, then you see a shift happen in Canada. Military spending starts going on the increase again. In fact, it's been going up ever since the late 1990s. And what happened at this point, this is 1998-1999, an important factor occurred. The government slayed the deficit and began posting surpluses that year. It was the first time that the government started bringing in more money than it was paying out in social programs and transfers to the provinces. And the military started reaping the benefits of that. Money started going back into defense and has been on the increase ever since. Now, you'll note here that this chart is chopped off. It only goes to 2006, but I told you I was going to project it to 2011. Well, what's the rest of this look like? Well, I got to tell you. In 2005, there was a budget that the Liberals brought in, supported by the NDP, that put $12.8 billion into defense spending over 5 years. One of the big lobby groups in Ottawa, called the Conference of Defense Associations, when they saw the number, their response to a reporter was this: it's staggering. They said, it's staggering. These are the guys that have complained for years that the military hasn't had enough money, and they had to admit that this was a huge increase in defense spending. Now, the Conservatives come along, and they top it up by another $5.3 billion on top of the $12.8 that the Liberal NDP budget of 2005 brought in. So I want to add this to the chart. Let's show you where it's going to go in the next 5 years. Practically off the chart. Look at that. Well over $20 billion, $21.5 billion to be precise, according to our new defense minister, Gordon O'Connor. $21.5 billion by 2010-11. And I'll just show you, this dotted line is actually the Liberal NDP budget of 2005, and the blue line is the Conservatives. So pretty much the same. Both, you know, all national parties supported this. An increase of 43.3% over 2005-06, 36.2% higher than at the end of the Cold War, the highest amount of spending since the Second World War. I mean, come on! During the 1980s, we were spending this amount to defend us. Thousands of nuclear weapons were poised at us. You know, long-range bombers, you know, nuclear submarines patrolling in the Arctic, all this Russian stuff out there, and we spent this much. And now we're spending even more than that? I mean, how many nuclear submarines does Osama bin Laden have? Because we're spending like he's got hundreds of them out there patrolling around, you know? So it's incredible the amount of money that's going into defense spending. And in fact, it's beyond reason. It's completely driven by politics now. The defense lobby has utterly won this debate. So Canada spends too little money on defense. About as Luxembourg? Well, clearly it's a myth. In fact, dollar for dollar, Canada is the 15th highest military spender in the world and 7th highest in the 26-member NATO alliance. And military spending is on the rise and will soon surpass Cold War era levels. Okay, urban myth number 3, last one. Canada is at war in Afghanistan to help the poor, send girls to school, and maybe even save kittens. Now, I kid you not, I know this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but I'm serious. We're there to save the kittens because I went to my doorstep just last week and picked up my copy of the Ottawa Citizen, and there in a huge front page photograph, almost took up the whole page, was a photo, right here it is, of a Canadian soldier, I mean pretending he's asleep, with his gun, cuddling up to a little kitten. This is the front page story. And the article goes on to talk about how the soldier, I mean, a nice guy, is on patrol and picks up this kitten and, I don't know, sleeps with it now. He sleeps with it now. I don't know what's going on. So, I mean, really, when I see this, you know, they are worried. They are very worried about this mission. When they resort to this level of just blatant, you know, heartstring pulling, trying to find support for this failing mission in Afghanistan, that now we're there to save the kittens. And in fact, this photo was taken by the military and provided to the Ottawa Citizen. Okay, so let's put this to the test. Fact or myth? Well, I think, like most troubling things these days, you go back to 9/11 and have a look at the trends, and you can follow it back to that September 11th day in 2001. And remember that speech by George Bush? You know, he just doesn't seem quite as scary anymore, does he, you know? He lost his Congress, he lost his Senate, he lost Rummy, you know, Rumsfeld's gone. But 2001, he was pounding the podium there, and he gave his speech, and this is, we all remember the line that he said, "Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists." Now, this wasn't a message directed at North Korea. It wasn't a message directed at Iran. It was directed at Canada and other U.S. allies. It was a message meant for us because the United States was signaling, we are now going to assert our position in the world. We have come under attack. We are about to embark on a war, and we expect you to get on side. And I tell you, it's fascinating that perhaps, you know, watching the towers collapsing on TV, somewhere over in the Department of National Defense headquarters, there was a room full of DND, Department of National Defense, analysts. And every year they produce the annual strategic assessment for the Department of National Defense that looks at the global situation of where the hotspots are and where the trouble could come from. The whole report doesn't mention 9/11 at all, except for an epilogue. And I can imagine them perhaps watching this on TV. They were just about to go to press with their assessment, but they had to write up something about what the impacts of 9/11 would be on Canada and the global situation. And so it's just about 3 or 4 pages, practically stapled onto the end as an epilogue. And if you read this, and the reference is included in the marching orders report, I tell you, we want to go find these people, and we want to say, please, tell us, what are next week's winning 649 lotto numbers? Because I swear, these people can see into the future. They knew exactly what the impacts of 9/11 were going to be. For instance, they predicted that ballistic missile defense would become a top priority. They predicted that the United States would probably establish a northern command and that Canada would follow suit. They predicted that concerns about civil liberties and human rights would be cast aside in favor of getting results in the war on terrorism. They predicted that, perhaps, you know, knowing that sooner or later there would be a Meher Arar at some point. They noted this. I'll just add this one quote here. Traditional U.S. allies will find that calls for military, diplomatic, and other support from Washington will be regarded as a test of their loyalty. A test of their loyalty. And those words, I think, resonate. And I think that the DND, the military analysts, knew this because they're probably the closest to the national security establishment in the United States. They probably knew them better than anyone else. And so they knew exactly what the reaction was going to be after 9/11. Now, if you're ever really curious about what the Canadian government is really thinking about a subject, don't bother going to Ottawa. Just go right on by. Go to Washington. Go down to Washington, D.C., because that's where you really find out what they're thinking in Ottawa. And if we were to go down to the White House here, and maybe if we were to peer in the windows, this is what we might see. There's Michael Wilson, our new ambassador to the United States. You remember him from that old movie about Brian Mulroney and everything. Well, it's all come back in reruns. Here's our man there next to George. George has got a six-shooter, you know, he's got this great. Someone pointed out the other day that maybe Michael was trying to learn how to do it, but he doesn't quite have the six-shooter, you know, draw line. But it's fascinating to go and look at what Michael Wilson is telling American audiences. So I went to his website, to the Canadian Embassy in the U.S. website, and I learned quite a bit by reading his speeches. First of all, I learned he gives practically the same speech to everybody. Same jokes, same everything. Now, I would never do that, but they have a little boilerplate that's going on down there. But this is one line in particular about Afghanistan. There's all kinds of interesting insights into this, but here's one on the global war on terror. This is what he's telling American audiences. Canada is an active contributor and partner in the war on terror, particularly with our activities in Afghanistan. Now, if you don't need a clearer connection than that, I don't know, you know, where you'll find it. But clearly, to the United States, we are telling to them we are committed, we are loyal through our contribution to the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. And if you were to sit in that speech that Michael Wilson was giving down there, and maybe you'd had enough and said, I got to get out of here, and headed to the subway, the Washington subway, to get back to your hotel, when you went down into that subway system, you might have seen this. A huge banner hanging in the Washington subway with Canadian soldiers on it. And look at what it says. CanadianAlly.com. Boots on the ground. Canadian troops in Kandahar, Afghanistan. U.S.-Canada relations, security is our business. Paid for by the government of Canada. In a huge advertising campaign that the embassy put on in the Washington subway systems, in particular in subway stops near the Pentagon. And this photo was snapped by a Canadian and emailed to a bunch of groups in Canada. It quickly made its rounds, as you can imagine, and newsrooms started picking up on it and found that this was in fact the case. And they did the research and found that tens of thousands of dollars had been spent on this. A clear indication of the message that our government is trying to communicate to their American colleagues. So again, Canada is at war in Afghanistan to help the poor, send girls to school, and maybe even save kittens. Clearly, it's a myth. Canada took part in the 2001 invasion, the NATO-led peace support mission, and the counterinsurgency war in the south to which we are there today to assist the U.S. war on terror and to curry favor with the Bush administration. Any benefits in terms of development or aid or protection of human rights for women is secondary. While laudable and important and certainly critical to do, that is not the reason why we're there. We are there to assist the war on terrorism, and as long as it's a priority in the United States, you know, we will continue to be there. So I think that's quite clear. So I think what's happening today in this country is there are two competing visions going on, vying for the hearts and minds of Canadians. One is this image of a Canadian soldier in the developing world wearing a blue helmet in a UN peacekeeping operation, extending a helping hand. But there are groups and lobbies going on right now, and even the government is involved in this, to try to disabuse us of this view and replace it with this one, the image of a Canadian sniper hiding, lying in wait, picking somebody off at great distances. You know, Canadians win medals at how good we are at sniping. And as you see in this photo that ran in the newspaper, it's subtitled Canada's Most Lethal Weapons, our snipers. So two views of our role in the world. One as helping under the UN, lending a helping hand. The other, a combative role, getting with it, getting on side with the war on terrorism. You know, there, in the old days, and even today, you know, they used to drop leaflets out of airplanes, right, on over behind the enemy lines. They would say, give up. There's no hope. Surrender, you know. And this is called like a psychological operation in military terms. Now, I think we are undergoing our own psychological operation today, that the military is using the equivalent of leaflets in Afghanistan or where have you, but using it through the media, through analysts, through whatever means they can to try to rewrite our history, to make us forget that we were once the number one contributor of UN peacekeeping troops, and to help us get on side with the war on terrorism. You know, in my spare time, I like to sit around and read Prophet magazine. I don't know if you enjoy Prophet magazine, but it's good for a laugh once in a while. But anyway, so Prophet magazine had an interview with Rick Hillier recently, along with a bunch of other CEOs, and this is what General Hillier said. He's our chief of defense staff. He said, "We get public speaking training, how to present a lecture or treat a subject. We had people from the BBC come in to help us create the right perceptions, because perception is reality." Perception is reality. So they're trying to create a perception that Canada spends little on the military, that nobody does UN peacekeeping anymore, and we're there in Afghanistan, you know, through humanitarian motives, when, as we've shown, we've put those myths to the test, and I think our Mythbusters have come through with the goods on that. So there is a competition going on right now, and that's why one of the reasons why I took time to write down the story of the campaign for missile defense in this book called Missile Defense Round One, because we're struggling against many of the same forces that are pushing this agenda. We're also pushing the missile defense agenda as well. And we always need some good news and a good story, and this is one of them. We were very fortunate at the Polaris Institute, where I was working, to be the secretariat for this fascinating, incredible campaign to try to convince Paul Martin to say no to George Bush on missile defense. And the campaign itself strung together community groups and individual activists across the country, and combined them with people who were experts, scientists, analysts, and also retired diplomats and members of parliament. And so we were able to combine the expert knowledge with the political knowledge and an on-the-ground grassroots campaign that eventually pushed Paul Martin to say no to ballistic missile defense. It's a real David and Goliath story, an incredible campaign. And I just want to share with you a little bit of what we were all faced with at that time. Let me take you back to, I want to take you back to December 2003. Okay, what was happening in December 2003? Well, Paul Martin had just been elected by the Liberal Party to replace Jean Chrétien as the Liberal leader. But he hadn't moved into 24 Sussex Drive and become Prime Minister yet. He was just about to come in. And at the Chateau Laurier that December 2003, the Chateau Laurier is this really fancy hotel just a stone's throw away from Parliament Hill. In fact, the Queen used to stay there, you know, when she would come on her royal visits. There was a conference being held. And the conference was called New Directions, Managing the Canada-U.S. Relationship. And the conference sticker price to get into this thing was $850 each person to get in. Now, when I see an admission price like that, that says two things to me. One, it says, all you powerful people in Ottawa, all you lobbyists, all you heads of the corporations, come inside. Come. This is important. We want you to be part of this discussion. You need to be here. And also $850 a ticket says, all you guys from Polaris and Council of Canadians and CCPA, don't bother. Stay home, you know. Go back to licking envelopes and, you know, sending out your appeals and whatnot, but don't come to this conference, which made us want to go all the more. So we cobbled together $850 and we bought a ticket, and I went in sort of undercover into the meeting to see what was going on this year. Well, now you remember the big business organizations were ecstatic that Paul Martin was coming in. They couldn't wait because they'd been backing him for years. And as Murray Diamond pointed out in his book, he was one of them. He was a CEO for Canada. He was just like all the lobbyists that had put him, that had backed him all those years. And now, finally, they'd gotten rid of that Chrétien guy who said no to Iraq and had spoiled the relationship with the United States, and now Martin was going to come in and set things right. The Ottawa political elites were adjusting to their new leadership, and this conference, like many others held on similar topics during this period, were designed to entrench the Martin agenda. And as if to underline this, as the conference opened, there, taking the stage as the conference co-chair, was one of the most successful of Ottawa's backroom operators, Tom DeQuino. And this is, when he went to the podium, this is what he said. I know, because I tape-recorded it. The signing of the Free Trade Agreement in 1988 marked a turning point in Canada's economic strategy that I believe has paid huge dividends. And now we must integrate our plans for achieving economic advantage within North America with a strategy for ensuring the security of both our own borders and the continent as a whole. And I was listening to this, you know, this image came to mind. What is he talking about? He's talking about a fortress North America, a castle wall that goes all the way around the continent, all the way around the United States and continues right around Canada. And we're inside the castle with the United States. Because these guys who had pushed for globalization and economic integration with the United States were afraid. They were afraid that as a result of 9/11, the United States was going to put the wall at the 49th parallel, at the border. And this would really mess up free trade. This would be a real problem and would undermine all of those years of work that they had put into place. So they come up with the idea, said, we have to convince the Americans to not build the wall at the border, put it around our border, put us inside the castle with them. That way, the economic integration can go on. But what would something like that require? If we were to join up with them in a fortress North America, I mean, it requires us adopting all of the U.S. security policies. Whatever they feel is important, we would have to feel is important. If they want to build a missiles defense system, well, sign us up. They want to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, how many troops do you need? We'll be there. You know, if they want to integrate security databases and monitor every single person that steps on an airplane in North America, hey, we'll do it and deny we did it if anyone gets caught in trouble. You know, that's the response that you would have in order to provide that level of security to convince the Americans to put the wall all the way around, if in fact you could ever do that. And arguably you would never convince the Americans to do it. But this is what these guys were doing. And in early 2004, one of the first things we did was we organized this big sign-on letter, and we asked prominent Canadians to sign on to it. We had Sarah McLachlan and Stephen Page and David Suzuki and Bruce Coburn, and it was an open letter to Paul Martin saying, don't give up our traditional role in the world. Don't give in to this view that's coming from the United States. We've always stood for nuclear disarmament. We've always stood against weapons in space. And we understand that the root causes of conflict are inequality and environmental degradation. And those are the values that we've always proudly stood for. Please, Mr. Martin, say no to ballistic missile defense and affirm those traditional values that Canadians have always held. That was our message at that time. And it was directed at Canadians as much as it was Paul Martin. And we put this online on our website, ceasefire.ca, and thousands of people came and added their name to the website. And every time they did, a copy of the email was sent to the Prime Minister's office. And by the end of the campaign, there were more than 50,000 emails had been sent to the Prime Minister's office opposed to Canada joining missile defense. So our theory was that the more that Canadians knew about missile defense, the more they would be opposed to it. And so we really put together an education and media awareness campaign. And one of the things that we did was, you know, we're competing against this defense and corporate lobby that have almost untold resources at their disposal, and we've got nothing, you know, a few nickels and good intentions to rub together. That's all we had. But we did have these community groups all across the country. We had a really good network of folks. We had the internet. We had, you know. So we said, well, look, how do we make this message the number one issue in the election? And this was in early 2004. The election was in June of 2004. So we came up with this idea of rapid response teams. So we called together. We had a big conference call. I remember this, and there was groups all across Canada. And we said, all right, get your placards made now. Get ready. We need people who can move at a moment's notice. And we're going to find out wherever Paul Martin goes, because he's always got reporters traveling with him, we'll call you. And you head down there as fast as you can with your placards, right? Yeah, I mean, it's not like Paul Martin actually publicizes his schedule in advance. So we had to watch the media really closely. And we'd say, he's in Charlottetown. So we'd phone Charlottetown and say, you know, he's down at Confederation House kissing babies at 1 o'clock. Get your signs. Get down there quick. And this is what happened. You see this photo here around the Charlottetown Guardian. This is a group of the Council of Canadians with their signs there, the security guards. Medicare, yes. Star Wars, no. And this is Paul Martin's first major event kicking off the campaign. And the media saw this. And not only did this photo run on the front page of the Charlottetown Guardian, but it was the lead story in the national news that night that protesters had showed up on missile defense. You know how many people were there? Six. Maybe eight if you use peace movement counting, you know. There were six, there must have been 20. But it was the effective use of the message at the right time, at the right place, and our ability to sort of move fast. And what was fascinating was that these groups of people, you know, they'd have to have the placards ready. You know, they all knew they probably had one shot at it. They had one shot, and they were ready for it. But they knew that while their team maybe had one shot, there was 4, 5, 10 other teams waiting for their turn. And together, they were part of a recurring message. And those same reporters traveling with Paul Martin saw this wherever he went. One time, we hit him. He landed in Victoria. We had him at the airport. We had him at an event downtown. Then he came back out to Surrey, and we were leafleting at that event in Surrey, all within 24 hours. So it was just a constant repetition. But people were coming together to be part of something greater than themselves. And that their voices were magnified all that more loudly. And we wanted to make this such a problem for Martin. You know, we just wanted missile defense to be like, you know, this dog grabbing Martin's leg, you know, and he's like walking around dragging this dog all the time. You know, would this thing get off? And I go into detail in my analysis of the reasons why Martin had no choice but to reverse himself and say no to missile defense. In the book, but these were the banner headlines, and I had this as my screensaver on my computer for about a year. I felt really terrible. I would just go and look at this and say, you know, look at the headlines. Canada says no to U.S. on missile defense. It's no. It's official. You know, Canada says no to missile defense. And then there was this whole thing about missile trade wars and Condoleezza Rice and George Bush wouldn't return Martin's call. I mean, it was fabulous. It was just fabulous. And it was a tremendous victory for all of us because we took on those powerful vested interests, we took them on, and we won. And we won because Canadian values were still on our side. You know, they can be confused at times. The Canadian public can be unsure of which way to go, but the values always remain strong. And now we've got Stephen Harper to contend with. And he's pledged to go back to the missile defense table if the United States ask. And although he denies that it's on his agenda, I think the missing word in that is yet, is yet. And as you can see already, the missile defense lobbyists are getting ready for round two. Here's the National Post from just a few weeks ago. McKenna urges missile defense. A liberal saying we should reverse their policy and what? Join with the conservatives and go join with the Bush and his missile defense system? I mean, what is he suggesting here? Colin Kenney, a senator, another liberal, issued a report from his committee that said Canada should join missile defense and space weapons. What's so bad about them anyway? You know, better ours than someone else's. Better our space weapons than someone else's space weapons going overhead. This is the level of the debate that's going on right now. So there's a bunch of scenarios that could unravel here. Canadians could go to sleep and forget about the issue. Polls could shift, you know, and politicians will jump on it at their opportunity. Already, the nuclear tests and the missile tests in North Korea have put tremendous wind in the sails of the pro-missile defense people, and they're pushing for it again. We could have a liberal majority, we could have a conservative majority. If we had a conservative majority, then Harper wouldn't have any qualms about going back to it, because he's committed to a vote in Parliament. He's committed to a vote on it. But even if he does have a vote, maybe he can get enough liberals to vote along with him to pass it, just like he did on the two-year extension on our mission in Afghanistan, an absolute failure, which is going to cost dozens of more lives and billions of more dollars as we carry out this two-year extension. Stephen Harper brought it to a vote in the House of Commons. Now, he's got a minority government. He needs some other party to help him pass these things. Where did he find his support? In the Liberals. Michael Ignatieff and his supporters, amongst others, voted with the Conservatives on extending their mission by 2 years. Stephen Harper was so grateful, he crossed the floor and shook Ignatieff's hand. There's no photograph of it, and I wish there was, because I don't think Ignatieff would be doing very well in the Liberal leadership race today if there was a photo of him shaking hands with Stephen Harper after that vote. But you could see the same kind of scenario open up on missile defense again. So we have to be campaigning continually on missile defense. And we have to remember that it's the same forces, the corporate and defense lobby, are also pushing our mission in Afghanistan. It's the same thing. In fact, we now know that only a few weeks after the missile defense decision, there was an important meeting in Ottawa, with Paul Martin, his Minister of Defense, his Foreign Affairs Minister, and Rick Hillier, to talk about what was going to happen in Afghanistan. And Hillier had a plan. He wanted a 1,000-strong battle group in the south, in Kandahar, the most dangerous part of the country, mostly because it would help the Americans. And in fact, it was that argument that convinced Martin that it would help the Canada-U.S. relationship, especially because Martin had just said no to missile defense a few weeks beforehand. So these issues were linked together. The lobby waits until the right opportunity, and then they come back again. So it's a mixed track record. You can see this is a constant struggle, tug of war, really, between these two visions and our forces. And there's been it's not completely one-sided. You see, the government said yes to the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, but they said no to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. We got a no on missile defense in 2005, but a yes to military spending increases and a transformation of our military into something away from peacekeeping toward something that's much more useful for the U.S. War on terrorism. So in Ottawa today, this is what we're confronting. We are confronting the combined forces of the corporate lobby and the defense lobby. And what we need to do, and maybe take some of the lessons that we learned in the missile defense campaign and other struggles, is we need to create our own new peace lobby. We need a peace lobby in Ottawa that confronts the corporate and defense lobby on Parliament Hill, in the newsrooms, and on the streets across the country, wherever they go. And we need to coordinate ourselves so that we can push for our traditional values and our vision of what Canada should be playing in the world. And we have some sign-up cards that I'll make available here for folks, and I hope that if you want to get connected in the campaign that we're mounting through the website ceasefire.ca, I would encourage you to do that. Fill them out and leave them with me here before you go. And I just want to end on one note, because you know, as I mentioned, I've been traveling across the country, 30 communities, and Canadian values are really strong. People feel conflicted. On the war in Afghanistan, Canadians support the troops, you know, and that's what makes them worried about them, because of the death toll so high. They want them to be safe and come home. Canadians want to help the Afghan people, but is the military the right way to do it? Is sending tanks and smart bombs the way to do it? They need an alternative. They need to see a different way of doing it, of approaching that. So while the values are there, we need to be able to show people that there's a better way of doing things, and we can win when we do that effectively. So in the face of all of these bad decisions that the government seems to be making, it does make me, you know, a pessimist about tomorrow. But when I think of Canadian values and how strong they are, it always makes me an optimist about the day after. So thank you very much, and I hope we have a great discussion tonight. Thank you so much.